Hello and welcome to another episode of Transformational Blueprints, where we try to put a dent in the large number of transformation programs that fail. Hosted by me, Mario Michaels, founder and director of Synaxia Group. On this series, we will bring you unique insights drawn from first-hand experience from some of the most high-profile architecture and transformation leaders across the globe. Topics told in order to share knowledge, experiences and ideas to inspire, innovate and give back to the architecture community. So grab a coffee, sit back and relax. Welcome everybody. Today we're going to be talking to Ian Holloway about why and how improving diversity in architecture makes absolute sense. For those of you who don't know Ian, Ian is an experienced chief architect with over 25 years experience. He's lived and worked across Europe, working across numerous. Recent role was group director of architecture at Lowell, one of Europe's largest debt management companies, where he led a team of over 50 IT professionals across 8 countries. He's worked for businesses such as EE, Capita, and UEFA. He set up new architecture teams as well as turning underperforming ones around. He's managed teams of up to 100 people as well as down to just one. Ian, good morning.
Good morning, Mario.
Thank you very much for taking the time out, Ian. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, life is good.
Good, good, good. Well, we always like to start the podcast with a little bit of background on yourself, you know, how you got to where you are essentially now.
Thanks, Mario. So, yeah, I took a slightly different route into architecture, and I started life as an accountant, which now I've put it on here, and then loads of people know about that. I don't normally talk about the early days of my career, but yeah, I started working for Ericsson's in the mid to late 90s in their accounts department. I quickly got exposed to IT systems, and I've always been interested in computers from a young age, but never quite got into development. So I was always on the more of the business side as an accountant, but I got the opportunity to work on some groundbreaking technology with Ericsson's. If you're old enough to remember, the first smartphones were Ericsson phones rather than the iPhone that everyone thinks was the first one. We had some back in the 90s. And we built our own credit control software, which I was lucky enough to roll out across Europe. And that really catapulted my IT career, just being interested and excited and seeing how you can really change businesses by putting the right information into the right systems at the right time. So really enabling changing business practices with really IT. And as you said in the introduction, I've been fortunate enough to live and work across Europe, worked for a variety of companies, and always had that interest from that early engagement, and always thinking about what's the impact on the customer, what's the impact on the balance sheet. And so, yeah, not the usual developer tester. Want to get paid more money moving to architecture. Mine was more from a business engagement and rollout, and actually seeing how we can really change businesses with transformation and architecture.
And that's the whole purpose of architecture, right? You know, rather than being a technology architect, it should be you're an architect that uses technology, if that's the right answer, to enable business growth or overcome challenges or whatever it may be. And I think that's, personally speaking to hundreds every single week, I think that's where a lot of people kind of lose the purpose of what architecture actually is. What do you think makes a great architect in today's world? You know, not a necessarily a chief architect, but if you were, let's say, a software engineer or a cloud engineer or somebody coming from accountancy that wants to make that transition as you did, or whatever it may be, what do you think makes a great architect?
So I think the first thing is getting the ear to mouth ratio right. So listen more than you speak, I think, is always good as you're starting out. Perhaps some of my early managers may disagree and said I was probably talking a little bit too much, but when I was talking, I was asking questions, I wasn't telling people. So I still do that today. You know, I ask the question why. I try to understand why we need to do that. Why do we need to invest many millions of pounds in a new system? And there has been instances where I've been speaking to stakeholders who got very excited about a new technology, and I said, well, actually, you can just use SharePoint to do that. And I've set it up for them in 5 minutes, and they're like, oh wow, I didn't know we could do that. So I think that's, you know, that questioning, trying to understand the capability, understand the business need is really important. And I think if you're inquisitive, then, as we'll talk about, I think in a little bit, you can be trained how to be an architect. You don't need to be the biggest technologist, the biggest brain in the room, but there are certain roles within architecture where absolutely you do need to be the Oracle expert to know how it works inside and out. But I think you can be a broader architect as well if you've got the right questioning ability.
Absolutely, yeah, 100%. And your role at Lowell, I know you've left there, but you reported into the CFO. Now, is that because you used to be an accountant, or was that just by chance?
I think it certainly helped in the interview. When you get interviewed by a CFO and you disclose that you used to be an accountant, then I think it did instantly give a bit of credibility. And that has certainly stood me in good stead throughout my career. I'm not suggesting all architects need to go get accountancy qualifications, but I think a little bit of understanding of profit and loss and balance sheet in terms like EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, amortization, will actually stand you out from other architects when it comes to building business cases. But at Lowell, it was probably the sweet spot for me as a proper, what I consider a proper enterprise architect. Reporting to the CFO, it wasn't just about the IT systems, it was about the organizational change. So we did some target operating model. We looked at the end-to-end business process, which impacts on the IT systems, both software and the infrastructure. And we also looked at the data as well, which is often forgotten. And sometimes as a different team looking at data, we did really look at the whole piece. So for me, it was a really sweet spot working to the CFO, and I really enjoyed it.
What was the, on that, I know that's what you gained after joining and stuff, but what was the thought process from their side going into this hire and bringing you on board from a reporting perspective?
So the group CFO within Lowell had responsibility for IT as well as finance as well. So at a group level, when I started, there were regional CIOs.
Yep.
And that was part of the transformation that I was involved in, looking at how we can consolidate our system. So the original conversation I had with Jamie, I hope he won't mind me mentioning his name, the CFO at Lowell, he said, I think we've got about 200 systems and we need to consolidate and simplify them. I came back a couple months later and said, actually you've got over 500 and there was massive duplication across Europe. The individual businesses were using different systems to do the same thing. So we had a chat about how do you really transform IT, and working with some of my colleagues across finance and HR and a couple of colleagues in IT, we looked at how and why we had such disparate systems, and it was largely because we had three regional CIOs supporting their business agenda but not looking at the opportunities that being part of a larger group had. So that's where we came with the target operating model and looked to consolidate those systems and bring them together. But first of all, we brought the people together, which is one of the key things. You know, if you want to be successful, you need to have the people on the same page and understanding the outcomes you're trying to drive.
We'll definitely dive into that, because people, I fundamentally believe people are a business's great asset, not technology. It is the people that either build, come up with the ideas, or et cetera, et cetera. And fundamentally, that's why I set up Synaxia Group, to support businesses doing that. I think, again, a lot of businesses misinterpret that and miss that. So we'll definitely come on to that later on in the conversation. I suppose the question I have is, and you're probably unique because you've been an accountant or you used to be an accountant, but what challenges did you face reporting into the CFO that you probably didn't have when you were reporting to a CIO in another role?
I think the first one is you being into the CFO, you get a lot more exposure to the senior execs. And so some of the regional CIOs I got on with famously, others there was a little bit more challenge, like, well, you're an architect, you should really report into me, how does that work? But on the whole, just by engaging, actually working together to solve problems, most of those challenges were overcome.
Okay, so it was more an ego thing from a CIO thinking you should report into me rather than reporting into somebody else, kind of thing, rather than actually this is the right thing.
I think a lot of organizations have that sort of pyramid into a CIO or a CTO. Yeah. And I think for me, like I say, as an architect, I like to challenge, but in the right way. And it was never about an ego, about who I report into and what I do. It's more about the opportunity and influence. But there was, I think, we ended up with the IT leadership team was myself. We had a group CIO and we had a group director of cybersecurity. The three of us were the IT leadership team reporting into that group CFO. And that gave us the right amount of tension between the three different disciplines to balance security with architecture, with the delivery and the ongoing support.
Because that's one of the biggest challenges at the moment, isn't it? Is balancing innovation with risk and security and so on. So being at the same table as the director of cybersecurity, you're able to challenge each other. You're able to, right, okay, we're doing this, but actually now, have you thought about it, this, and what impact it will have from a risk perspective? So I can imagine that worked really good, really, really well. It baffles me that other businesses don't have similar reporting lines.
I guess the challenge is having the opportunity to have three people into a board member. That was sometimes a challenge, but we were senior experienced professionals. We didn't need sort of micromanaging, so we could come on every couple of weeks. We had a team meeting with the CFO, and the rest of the time we were working, the three of us, side by side, rather than having to have that time and hand holding and being told what to do.
And were there ever any sort of conflictions from, you know, investment versus innovation, which naturally everybody always thinks, oh, well, reporting to the CFO, they're just going to cost cut, cost cut, cost cut. Were there any conflictions like that? And if there were,
we did joke about sometimes there's slightly different agendas amongst the three of us, but we worked through that. You know, we often said, and this is one of the sort of, again, going back to giving tips and recommendations to people, is you, in public, you agree and you support each other, but then you disagree and resolve privately. And that's something I've got to know over the last probably 10 years, I think, is it's not about winning or losing an argument in a meeting. It's actually supporting colleagues and developing and doing what's right for the business and trying to leave the ego at the door and not always trying to sort of win. I think that's important, is to think, well, actually, if you disagree with someone, just say, let's just talk about that afterwards, because we're not going to resolve it now. And so many times I've been in those awkward meetings. It's probably even worse on Teams when you've got two people who are just arguing for the sake of it and everyone switches the camera off and goes to sleep.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
trying to get away from that and say, okay, well, if we can't agree, that's okay, but let's just take that offline and let's work out how we're going to resolve that difference of opinion.
I think you touched on something really, really important there, leaving your ego at the door. And I think that is the bit where people just don't realize how much impact, positive or negative, that sentence and that action can actually have on meetings, processes, strategy, whatever it may be. Just, we're all here for one common goal, and that's to make the business better for whatever reason, in whatever capacity. Leave your ego at the door. If we can sort of move on to sort of your architecture leadership career, just to give people a bit of context, then what was, in my introduction, we spoke about teams of sort of 50 to 100. What was the makeup of these teams? Surely they're not all architects.
No, if that was 100 architects, that would kind of be a big team. There's been a few different teams, with the biggest two of the UK telecoms. One was a mixture of business analysts, solution designers and solution architects, as well as lead architects. Another one, the role was bigger than architecture, so it was everything in the digital space. So anybody who wasn't involved in the website or the app, actually building, testing or operating, was in my team. So that was BAs, solution designers, solution architects. We had some scrum masters, project managers, agile coaches, release managers. So my role actually grew to pick up those additional disciplines as well. So we did everything apart from the development, testing and running of the website for that one particular company. So real mixed bag, but it had to have that end-to-end view, and actually recognizing that the best architects are the ones who work with the best project managers and BAs and release managers, and actually have that end-to-end involvement. I've seen some architecture teams, not all, but there are a few who tend to be a little bit removed. In fact, one of the telcos I mentioned, the first one, when I joined, the architects were very used to sitting together. This was before COVID. They would physically all sit together, and occasionally they would send an email to one of the development teams telling them what to do. And I broke that down and said, no, you need to be sat with the teams. If we're going to, we were moving from waterfall to agile as well. So it was, you know, a big transformation of the business. But I did say, go forth and sit with the developers and work in the squads and actually find out what they need. And that was some of the team there, not all, but there were a few ex-developers who still thought they were the best developer and they should tell the developers what to do. And that always makes me, you did it there, the face that you pull when I heard that is like, actually, you know, take your car to a garage, you don't tell the mechanic how to fix it, you ask for their help. You might have a conversation about it because you know a little bit about cars. You don't tell the expert how to do their job, and that's what I try and get the architects to recognize, that, you know, whilst one day they were the best Java dev in the West, yep, you do need to recognize that things move on, and it's often a conflict I've seen with really experienced developers who end up getting moved into architecture roles because they are the most senior person, and let's be honest, they want to get a pay rise because there's still a bit of disparity, I think, between senior devs and architects, which in my view is wrong. But they move across and they're frustrated. They don't want to engage with the stakeholders. They want to be hands-on keyboard. So they ended up being a frustrated architect. So I think it's important recognizing that and trying to develop career frameworks to allow senior developers to be senior developers without needing to move into an architecture or management role, which is not suited to their skill sets or their expertise, just to get paid more money.
Exactly. Or to have a say on the technology the business uses without having to have the leadership and managerial responsibilities, because a lot of people don't like that, and they're not, you know, they're just not akin to being able to do one-to-ones and get the best out of people. They don't want to, you know, sometimes quite rightfully, you know, it's not the easiest part of the job. So developers and engineers, from my experience, do look at architecture and think, well, I can go and have a real influence on technology and not have to manage. So that's great. Oh, and guess what? I get a pay rise as well. Amazing. Why didn't nobody tell me about this earlier on? But I suppose, you know, the wider implications are massive, I suppose. But that, so you're in a really good position then to be able to, I suppose, tell us why you believe, according to Gartner, something like 82% of transformation programs fail. Now, you've managed transformation projects, managers, BAs, Scrum Masters, architects, etc., but all the people that are in the sort of plan and deliver side of transformation. So, you know, why do you think transformations fail?
Yeah, that was a scary stat when you shared that on the email the other day. It was like, crikey, that's, fortunately that's not my experience. But then when I started reflecting, I was like, actually there has been quite a number of large transformations which didn't go as planned. And so in preparation for this, I was thinking, well, actually what were the successful ones doing differently, and what the ones that are failing? And I think it was a common theme, which I think is running throughout this conversation. It was people. The transformations that were most successful were the ones that really engaged and empowered the teams to understand the objectives and then cleared the way to allow the teams to deliver. I think the transformations that I've seen fail spectacularly, and there has been some, I won't name them, but there were some where there was litigation and various, I don't think it went to court, I think it was settled out of court, one in particular I'm thinking of, but there was, you know, FTSE 100 companies falling out with some big systems integrators for many tens, maybe even hundreds of millions of pounds of damages and blame and this, that and the other. And it was, I think, because in that situation the teams didn't come together, they didn't recognize that they actually needed each other to work. It was very us and them, and, you know, let's get one over on the supply, oh, let's screw the customer. You know, it's like, no, actually, to be successful, irrespective of which company you work for, if you work on a program or a transformation, to be successful you need to energize and empower people. And that, I think, reflects my leadership style, is very much servant leader. I'm there, and I often say to my teams, you know, what can I do to help you? What's the impediments that I need to remove to allow you to be the best version of yourself, the best architect, the best BA? And that's really what I enjoy doing about the roles I've had.
And do you think that's how you get the buy-in, is by almost being servant to them and asking them, how can I enable you to be more successful? How can we reach your goals together? So is that fundamentally the biggest
having those way conversations. It's having those conversations, but I think it's, you do need, sometimes there's change in strategy, sometimes there's old technologies which are out of date, out of support. And so that's always a hard conversation. If someone, for example, mainframe systems, it's still a cornerstone of our industry, and it does make me smile when people are talking about AI taking over the world. I'm like, crikey, the last few companies I've worked for, they've had 40-year-old systems which AI is not going to replace. No one knows COBOL or, you know, these systems. So I think it's, you know, you do need to get people to understand why things need to change. I think far too often there's just doing a transformation and you forget about the message to the people who are going to be directly impacted, the people, the developers, the users of the system. So yeah, I think you do need to empower them to get on board, but at the same time, as leaders, we need to be able to explain why there is a need to change. Sometimes the nuances and the frameworks and the implementation is it should be, I think, a little bit more flexible, rather than, right, we're going agile, we're using SAFe, we're using version 5, we're doing X, Y, and Z, you need to do this, you need to do that. We're actually saying, well, you know, these are the sort of roles we need, and try and get people to see it as the opportunity. And unfortunately, on the way, you're not going to be able to change everybody. But I think if you make an inclusive workplace where people feel comfortable to talk about their objectives, but also the challenges, because there are challenges along the way, and you're a supportive leader, then that's when the transformation will be incredible and everyone will see the benefits for themselves. But there are occasions where some people just don't want to change and don't want to be involved, and that's always a difficult conversation to have.
Yeah, I can fully appreciate that. And without getting too sort of granular on that, have you got any examples of where, as a team, you've, you know, got a whole team on board, not every single person, but the majority of a team on board, and how you did that, other than having those conversations. I suppose, is there any little nuggets that you know, if you were a leadership coach, you say, oh, have you tried that?
One of the things that stood me in good stead throughout my career is a gentleman called Ken Blanchard, quite famous management consultant. His situational leadership, I still have it today. I usually have it to hand, but I've had a few weeks off work, so I haven't got my notebook where I have the four quadrants of situational leadership. That I think is really important, and having that framework, so it's not just Ian Holloway say, look, this is, there's a load of science behind this, but just talking to an individual when they're doing a task and saying, you know, have you done this before? Do you know what's expected of you? And then based on their experience and their outcomes, you can then adjust your management style, but also recognize that you can't necessarily teach everybody how to do every task yourself. So there's a lot of things where I say, well, actually, you know, if you wanted to get into the nuts and bolts of web development and Java or AWS, I can give you an architect view. But if you want to go a bit deeper as an architect to understand a bit more how it works to help you in the future, then let's look at who's available. So recognizing that as a manager and as a leader, it doesn't always have to be you telling the team what to do, but using that situational leadership framework, you can identify if it's a task someone's never done before, they're going to need training. Can I do that? Can an external trainer do that? Can somebody in the team do that? And then that facilitates a really easy conversation in the future, because people know it's actually okay to say, I don't know. And that's, again, you know, takeaways is to say, I don't know, or I've made a mistake. That's not the end of the world. It's not life and death, hopefully. And make a framework and an organization where people can put their hand up and say, I need help. I've not done this before. And then that's when you find teammates start helping each other out, because they actually, you know, it's naturally, I find, nice to help people.
Of course it is. And as a leader as well, you're able to adapt your approach to it. So, you know, micromanagement, for example, and KPIs, they've all got a really bad stigma attached to them. But I remember when I first started it in my career, I needed micromanaging because I didn't know what I was doing. So I needed someone to say, at any point where I was going wrong, just to step in and say, right, here are the reasons why you're going wrong. This is what you need to do. Now, everybody hates being micromanaged, but ultimately, if you're going to get better at something, you need direction. And then,
I would challenge you, Mario, and say not everyone hates micromanaging. You hate micromanaging if you're at the fourth stage of development, when you know what you're doing, but someone still thinks you don't know what you're doing. That's when people hate micromanaging. So your example is you didn't know, say, KPIs. You didn't have to use KPIs, so somebody helped you and defined and checked in and had that regular. But I bet as you got used to it, they stepped away and almost, you know, the Homer Simpson disappearing into the hedge thing.
Yes, yeah. So, they should. That's leadership, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where the stigma of my, and I talk about the sort of the stigma that it has attached to it. Oh, we'll do this. Nobody ever says, oh, we'll micromanage you at the beginning of your career. Say, oh, we'll micromanage you, or oh, they're a micromanaged business. That's not the case. It's, you're right. There's different stages of where people, and as you say, when you become a master at something, or you're tweaking mastery, then it's stepping back and watching people become better and better, and overtake your skill set in that as well, because they are becoming a master and you're not in that particular area. So yeah, really interesting. And
the best analogy I've heard, example for that, I think, and if there's any football fans listening, then hopefully this will resonate, you know, you can be the, let's say, the best midfield player that England's had in the generation, Steven Gerrard.
Yes.
You know, he got to
we
be,
can agree on something there, Ian.
I did remember you said you're a red. And then he goes into management, and all of a sudden he's not the greatest. And that's because it's a different situation. So he needs more training and more support and more micromanagement to become a better manager. Just because you're a great midfielder, that, as we've seen many, you know, Brian Robson, the previous generation, again, a fantastic manager. A fantastic midfielder, but not as successful as a manager. So taking a person out of what the situation, albeit literally in the same field of football, but then moving into a different role, if they haven't got the right support and the framework in place, unfortunately, they're not going to be as successful.
Exactly. Oh, I could talk football all day. Now, when we sort of initially chatted, you mentioned a great story about what you did during your time at a telecoms business around the team engagement score and what it was and how you improved it. Are you able to sort of share that story? Because that was something where I thought, that is an amazing idea.
Yeah, so it was, I was asked to come in and take over from a previous head of architecture. One of the big challenges was the engagement scores were really low. The team was disengaged, and this was I started this organization 3 months before COVID hit. So was in the office getting to know people, and it was clear they were just not engaged. A lot of them had checked out, silent quitting, I think we call it now.
Yep.
But back then that wasn't a phrase we'd used or even knew what it was. So I was having to spend a lot of time just getting to know the team, understand the problems, and just give them a chance to get to know me. So most of the things I've talked about, you know, giving them access to me, asking them what's working, what's not working, and just sort of facilitating open conversations was what happened. COVID then hit. So all of a sudden, my being able to take people for a coffee in the office or just swing by the desk or generally sense the mood was challenged. So we're in this brave new world, as everyone remembers, working from home, and I was still trying to improve the engagement. So lots of check-ins, lots of open sessions with the team. But one of the things which I got loads of positive feedback on was I would my morning dog walk, and I was quite fortunate to live in the countryside, so outside my back gate is a field. So I'd take my dog for a walk in the morning, and I just started recording a 5 or 10 minute video to the team when it wasn't too windy. So the team got to meet the dog, they got to meet me a bit more, my thoughts for the day, how I was coping with COVID. And you know, I was quite open about the mental health challenges as a manager, because it was, I think, tough for us all. And a lot of people look to their managers as like, oh, you must know what's going on. And it's like, well, actually, you know, this has never happened before. You can't get trained to do this. We're working through it together. We'll try and give you as much information we can, but we don't know what the government's going to say. We don't know what the medical experts are going to say. So I was just trying to let people know that, you know, that's okay. We are working through it, and just make myself available. And then from introduction to the dog, then on the calls, when we're waiting to start our meeting or at the end, their dogs would suddenly bark and they'd get all flustered and say, I'm sorry, the dog's barking. It's like, it's all right, introduce us to the dog. And so they'd introduce us to the dog. Or if the kid came into the room, then they were sort of trying to push the kid out. It was like, no, bring your kid up, introduce them, and just break down those barriers to do that. And yeah, one of the highlights from the management team was, if you're familiar with the TV game show Taskmaster, I did a virtual Taskmaster game with my management team. But I said, look, let's do it after hours and let's do it with your families. And so there was 8 managers and their families around the country on Teams one evening, and we were getting them to make paper aeroplanes and see how many onesies they could stack on the back of a hound. And what was the other one we did, which was really funny, was seeing how far you can throw a tea bag.
Oh, right.
People are really struggling with, but one person had obviously seen the show, and the secret was that Frank Skinner did this. If you put the tea bag, it'll go a lot further. Obviously, he didn't decide it makes a mess, but there was a few complaints. But just breaking down those barriers and letting people know that they weren't alone, ultimately helped include in, it's about a 60-point swing of the engagement scores after 6 months, which I was quite proud about. But for me, that wasn't a secret sauce. It was just being authentic as a leader, showing your vulnerabilities, making yourself available, building those connections as well, and making people feel like it's okay for your kid to interrupt you, because they're probably having troubles as well. Yeah. It's okay if the dog barks when the postman comes in, and that's kind of normal. So it's just making it okay for people not to be okay.
You took the words out of my mouth, showing vulnerability. And I think a lot of leaders are expected to be macho, you know, yeah, I'll take the world on my shoulders kind of things. And ultimately, it's that authentic, you know, Simon Sinek talks about it all the time. Authenticity in leadership will help you build relationships, will get you that buy-in that you need. And it will allow you to, or it will help you inspire people to take action and to do effectively what is asked of them to do. So yeah, really, really interesting. So thanks for sharing. You're really passionate about diversity in architecture, aren't you?
Not just in architecture. I think generally in life, I think it's important. You know, the more teams can reflect the customers and society, I think the better they are. I think there is. It's. I don't think I mentioned this to you before, but I'll mention it now. Sometimes when I'm on architecture calls or virtual events, I'll look around the team's call and I'll just say, this is the worst game of Guess Who ever. If you remember the kids' game where you have the, you know, are they bald? Are
they white? Do they wear glasses? Have they got brown hair?
Right, bald, glasses, beard. So you're faced with a screen of 20 people who all look the same. That doesn't reflect your customers. It doesn't reflect society. So I'm it's always hard as a, I think my wife described it as, the correct term is a cis white man. So, you know, I'm the sex that I was born with. I'm a middle-aged white man. I've been reasonably successful in my career. It's probably been a little bit easier. I haven't faced the challenges that other people have. But I think it's important to be an ally for those different people, to support them, whoever you are, whatever your background, religious, sexual connotation, whether you like dogs or cats, you know, wherever you come from, is to make an inclusive work environment and to recognise that. As a white middle-aged man, I've had it relatively easy, you know, and to try and make it as easy for others as it has been for me.
There's some really interesting statistics out there, and I'll just run through them because they're quite shocking. And as you know, I've done this market for years, and whatever you try to do, you know, it's like turning the Titanic. So according to a recent IASA article, 10% of architect roles are represented by females, 28.5% of business architect roles are represented by females, 6.2% of software architect roles, and then 18.8% of data architect roles are performed by females. Now, I fully appreciate the caveat to this, by the way. I fully appreciate gender is just one small chink in diversity, in the diversity and inclusion armor, so to speak. But that's shocking. And the most shocking thing about that is actually the more technical the role or the background, the lower the percentages. So 28.5% of business architects are female. That's above market average within technology, so to speak. So, you know, not where we need to be, but, you know, definitely there. What do you think the reason, in your opinion, obviously this is opinion based, but what do you think the main reason behind that, those such low percentages of gender diversity in architecture is?
I think there's a historic thing around male and female roles, I think, and that's the fundamental thing. It's like, you know, boys do computers and girls don't, is some people's view, and that's really hard. So yeah. I think it's important to make these roles accessible. I think you know, when I'm hiring, I do as much as I can, and there's some great software out there now to anonymize the job descriptions and to make sure they're not gender biased. I think I forget the qualification, sorry, the statistic, but with must have skills on a job spec, I think if a guy can do half the must have skills, he'll throw his hat in the ring. And
60%.
And a lady will think they have to do 100%. And I know from fact, when I'm speaking to my wife in the past, she's like, well, I can't do everything listed. And it's like, well, I don't think anyone expects you to do. You can put that candidate there. But changing it so it doesn't say, you know, must have skills, I think is an easy thing. And there's a lot more reading, a lot more intelligent people than me have done papers on this and use the software. But I think to start with is, you know, make adverts more gender neutral, I think is really important. But it goes back earlier than that, and this was something we were doing, and I will say the company this time because I think it's important. It's EE was probably at the forefront, I think, of inclusivity and trying to do more to get more diverse teams. And so we did quite a lot as my team, and it wasn't just the women in the team doing it, because I think that's the thing, saying, you know, it should be down to the women to get more women to tech. I think if there's not many women in tech, then they can't always be doing things to improve diversity. But I think we need to be supporting and be allies to do that. And as you mentioned, you know, we talk about gender quite a lot as because that is, you know, one of the biggest diversity challenges we face, with, you know, it's a 50-50 world we live in. All the other genders all the other genders and all the other things around diversity are equally as important. But I think in this particular case, let's crack the male female problem first. So we would go into schools, we would show them that, you know, there are jobs and interesting opportunities in technology for women, and it wasn't always jobs for the boys, and just try and break down that barrier. And I think the expression, if you can't see it, you can't be it, was really relevant. And so we tried, and I think we were successful to a certain extent, is getting more younger people interested. We did a lot of events. I remember an event I went to at Twitter in London, where it was inner city London school kids, and I was talking about the women in my team, and some of the young girls were just amazed that there were women in senior management positions in tech. They just didn't know that was available. So just making them available, and it doesn't always need to be for the company you're working for as well. I think talking to school kids is going to be, you know, 15, 20 years sometimes before you see them doing the roles, excuse me, that I've been looking to do. But you need to start doing it. And I think we've got a responsibility, not just to the companies we work for, to get a better gender diversity report, but society to address this and give people the opportunities.
Yeah, and you're 100% right. And just going back to the change in the job ad, there's I don't know if you know, Atlassian, the huge Australian software business, they used a piece of software, and over a 2-year period, just by changing the job copy, they increased 80%. They had an 80% increase in hiring women in technical roles globally over a 2-year period. That's amazing, just by something so simple and so cheap, being able to do that. And I think, you know, there's so much documentation out there around why diverse teams are, you know, are more likely to outperform their peers. You know, McKinsey have done a report and so on and so forth. The worrying thing I'm most worried about is, so I like numbers, I like statistics and so on. So I did a bit of research, and I think architecture as a whole has a huge problem, which we're not going to see it unless we do anything now. We're not going to see it for another sort of 8 to 10 years. So I looked at UK architects with, you know, generic job titles, solutions, business, cloud, software, etc. And the ones with less than 2 years experience, there's only 301 in the whole of the UK with less than 2 years experience. 2 years to 4 years experience is 749, and it goes up and it increases. When we get to 15 to 20 years experience, there's 25,000 architects in the UK. So it's an upside down pyramid. So we've got no chance. You know, there's not enough architects, let alone diverse architects, at the bottom end, at the entry level, to then fulfill that top end. So, you know, we do have a serious problem. So going into schools is definitely one way to start raising awareness around what an architect does, or generally what you can do within technology. You know, that social media app that you're on, you can build something like that in the future. You know, believe that you can, and, you know, get yourself on the right track now to be able to do that. So very good. Okay, well, we always like to end the conversation with a few quick fire questions, so indulge me if you may. First one, what do you expect in 2024 will be a game changer from a technology perspective?
So I was going to try and keep a straight face and say AI will take over the world as in Terminator. But I think the AI bubble might burst a little bit, because I think we've seen quite a lot of hype, certainly this last year. Speaking to colleagues at different organisations, IT directors and the like, there's a lot of demand for the board to say, oh, we need to have an AI thing, but they don't know what it is. So having that use case for AI, I think, is really important, but also recognising that, you know, if you've got a 40-year-old mainframe, then AI is not going to fix your IT problems. But there's AI is, for me, from what we're seeing, badged as AI, is nothing new. There's been a lot of robotic automated systems in the past, things like Blue Prism, some of the web chat things where they have scripting. I can remember, crikey, when was it put in web chat at O2? It's probably 10 years ago. And there was, you know, automated scripts and decision-based logic. So that's nothing new. So I think calming down a little bit on AI and recognizing that there is services that can improve customer services, I think that'll that'll be a game changer. But I think the biggest challenge for me is getting the diversity and really helping change some of those stats, because those figures were shocking, and we collectively need to do more to change that. Otherwise, it's going to be a problem in the future.
100%. Thanks for that. What advice would you give to a newly appointed chief architect?
Congratulations.
All commiserations, depending on the situation.
I think it's an exciting opportunity, and I've just signed up for my next gig as well, and it's already got me excited about what I'm going to be doing. So getting to meet the team, understand who's in there, who's on board, who's skeptical, who's challenged by the new arrival, I think is really important.
Yep.
A lot of the interviews I've had recently, we talked quite a lot about stakeholder management and how you do that. And so for me, in any architecture role, my two main stakeholders, which usually surprise people, is my finance business partner and my HR business partner. So if you get on board with the finance and HR teams, it does certainly make things, you know, really possible. Understanding where the budgets are, where the people are at, where the engagement scores are at, that if you look at those things, that will help, because you can jump straight into looking at the tech and looking at the strategy and, right, we're going to introduce System X, we're going to decommission System Y, but without the money, without the people, it's going to be a challenge. So yeah, people first, person-centered approach, I think, is the correct parlance.
That's definitely sort of thread itself through the whole conversation, I'd say 100%. And while we talk about interviews, what's the hardest interview question you've ever had?
I don't think I won't say hardest, but it was one recently that I had, which really made me think, and it caught me out because I've not been heard it before. It's him. Who was your most inspirational leader? And that was, I thought that was it really got me thinking about some of the people I've worked with. And I will name check Mark Thera, who's the BT Consumer CEO, because I think he was one of the most inspirational leaders I've ever had. And when I was lucky enough to work with him, for him, in much lower down the organization, but I did get to meet him a few times. And at one occasion he did sort of empower me, and he, at the time it was Kevin Bacon, was, well, Kevin Bacon's still doing the EE ads, but the catchphrase was, "Who says you can't?" And it was when EE and BT were coming together, and Mark was the CEO for EE, and he said, "Ian," he said, "just make sure that you keep doing what you're doing. You're living the EE spirit, and if anybody says you can't do something from a change, or, you know, this is how BT do it versus this is how EE do it, just say, 'Who says you can't?'" He said, "You've got my permission to, with respect, be disruptive and be that young, cool brand." And that was something that really stood out to me, the fact that he knew my name, but he was really passionate about keeping the spirit of EE alive, even though BT was taking over EE.
Yeah, brilliant. That's amazing advice. Any advice you wish you'd heard or received earlier on in your career, or would that be it?
No, I think reflection is really important. And so I think there's been some highs and lows. You know, I'm a massive advocate for men's mental health, which is not often talked about. If it was November, I'd shave the beard off and I'd be speaking here with a big mustache, looking like some convict or something. But I think speaking to my younger self, I'd say, you know, it's going to be okay. There's going to be some ups and downs, but don't beat yourself up too much for the downs, and it does come back. But at the same time, speak about it. Don't hide away and thinking you need to man up and tough it out. Just actually reach out for help, because the more you ask for help, the more help you'll get and the better you'll be.
Brilliant. No, again, thanks for that. And what do you think the biggest change you expect to see in the market from a talent perspective over the next 5 years?
So I think we've seen an interesting cycle during COVID, where certainly from personal experience, I'm based out of Leeds, but I was applying for and getting jobs in and around London. And so the world was certainly smaller. I think that's starting to change now, and people are wanting to return to the office. I think there's the balance hasn't quite been found. There are some roles which are more remote, but I think there's also opportunities for people to maybe not put in a full shift, I would describe it as. And that's not suggesting you need to micromanage, but I think we're going to see a lot more fractional work. So fractional CIOs. I've been toying with the idea of starting a fractional architecture business, which is something I'm going to put on hold now, signed this new gig, but I think that's something in future. And so rather than a Monday to Friday 9 to 5, I think there's going to be a lot more piecework, a lot more people signing up for a couple of days a week for 6 months to do a particular project and then move on to the next thing. And I think that's going to be disruptive from a talent perspective, because, as you mentioned, you know, there's a big sway of us experienced chaps, but I think we need to address how people are getting into the industry and getting into architecture. Otherwise there's going to be a problem in the future. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting ride. Not sure if that really answered your question, but
no, it does. Yeah, absolutely. And I completely agree. There's a melting pot of potential disasters if not managed correctly by businesses and by people. You know, people need to outlay their expectations, but also why? You know, why do you want to work from home remotely all day every day? Oh, well, it's because I've got, you know, got to do the pickup and the drop off. Okay, well, let's work around that and get yourself into the office when you've done that. Because I think what we're finding, or what I'm finding with people, and I speak to candidates who covertly are on the market, they don't feel that connection to the business they're working for like they did pre-COVID, because they don't have relationships with people, those water cooler chats, as we always call them. You know, they're building relationships through a screen. Now, that you can do that, but it's not the same. You lose, you know, 30 to 40% of that. So effectively, your job.
A little anecdotal story on that. Years ago, again, it was at EE, we had an offshore team, and we once a week we had an all hands video call with them. But it was just they were just in a blank office, and it was through an Indian outsourcer, and we thought it doesn't feel like they're part of the team, and they didn't really feel part of the team. So next time we did a visit, we just took loads of merchandise over, you know, and it's silly things like branded cups, pens, banners. But all of a sudden, everyone's like, they're drinking their tea from the EE mug, you know, they're writing with the EE pen, there's the EE posters around the wall. So whenever we had a marketing company, we shipped a load of stuff out. And overnight, they felt part of it. And I think that's, you're exactly right. We're all working from home. You could be working for any company.
Anyone.
You know, I've got a plain background behind me. It could be anywhere. So trying to get people to feel that engagement and part of a brand and part of a culture is really important. And I recognize there is benefits from working from home, but I think it's also important for staff retention, for people to feel part of it, but have a reason to go in the office, not just you need to be in the office Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 9 to 5, because people go in the office, but they won't be engaged. They'll just be sat on team call. So be clear why and where you need people and get that balance right. And then I think you'll have a happy workforce.
100% completely agree. Well, sadly, Ian, we've run out of time. It's been really, really interesting chatting to you about diversity, about different reporting lines, about why you believe transformation programs fail. So thank you so much. It's been a really interesting conversation, a great podcast episode. So yeah, thanks for your time. Thanks for your wisdom. And yeah, I look forward to speaking with you soon. And congratulations on the new gig, by the way.
Thanks, Mario. Take it easy.
Awesome. Thanks very much. And that's a wrap. Sadly, we're at the end of another Transformational Blueprints episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and there were plenty of golden nuggets for you to take away. If you're a fan of the show, please do remember to share, like and leave reviews so that more people from our industry get to hear and benefit from these too. Please also follow Synaxia Group on LinkedIn to keep up to date with new episodes. Links in the show notes. Join us next time for another episode packed with tips and advice from senior leaders in the technology world.